history of biotechnology.
Wow. Wow. So so it will be well documented. Will there be several communication vehicles? You're going to write a book or somebody?
Yeah. Yeah. We're working on a book on the origins of the industry right now. In the like mid-70s through mid-90s.
Yeah.
And then that's volume one. Right?
Yeah.
And we're publishing a magazine. I don't know if you're if you're not on the mailing list, we'll put you on it.
Please do. Yeah.
So there's lots of interesting stuff in there.
Okay.
And we've got educational programming. Do lots of stuff.
Wow. Okay. Well, I would love to. I would love to see it. Sounds like you got some interesting resources.
Okay. Well, let's start at the beginning. Okay, this is a biography.
Yeah.
So tell me a bit about where are you from? I mean, I know where you're from, but tell me about it.
I grew up in a very small town in Kansas. So that's
Fredonia.
Fredonia, quintessential small town, Kansas town. Probably 4,000, 3,000 people in it.
Mm-hmm.
Probably less now.
Very rural.
Yeah.
Community, farming community.
Yeah.
Was your family farmers? Or?
My father and grandfather ran the drugstore in town.
And schooling was probably, how many students in your class?
98 in my graduating class.
Oh, well, that's actually pretty good.
Yeah.
Pretty good size.
Yeah,
so you've got people coming from all over the county.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. But again, I think it's much smaller now. I'll bet it's just small Kansas towns don't thrive like they used to.
Yeah.
So I think it's probably 40 or 50 in the graduating class now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're growing up in the 50s and 60s. What was that environment like?
Just what you'd think. Rode your bike everywhere, kept your door unlocked. If you went to the next town 30 miles away, that was a big deal.
Yeah. What was the nearest big town?
Well, it was an hour and a half to drive to Wichita, 2.5 hours to drive to Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
One of my daughters described it best when they were young, taken back to see their grandmother, and we got up really early one morning to drive to Kansas City to catch a flight. So they got in the car and fell asleep. And about an hour or two later, one of them wakes up and looks out the window and goes, "Well, I thought we'd be somewhere by now."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you work in the drugstore?
I did. Mm-hmm. I did. You know, swept, took out the trash, then kind of progressively got more responsible jobs like restocking shelves.
Yeah.
And then actually worked after I got my pharmacy license, worked there kind of for a month or two between college and graduate school.
As a pharmacist.
As a pharmacist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And growing up, did you learn the business? Did you get involved in that? Bookkeeping and
Well, I remember closing the store, you know, when they locked the doors and closed for the day, you know, you kind of, mm-hmm. back then, you counted the money in the cash register. That was the day, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No credit cards, no nothing. A lot of credit for the farmers, so, you know, the farmers could charge until the crops thing happened.
Yeah.
But it was a cash business.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And did you have, growing up and going to school, did you have an idea about, when did you want to become a pharmacist? When did that idea come?
Well, I remember two things. At one time when I was a little kid, we went to Kansas City and my parents took us to the airport. And I remember thinking, and I saw these guys coming in with their briefcases and getting on planes. And I remember thinking, that is what I want to do. I want to go someplace and do something.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was in college, I woke up one day and said, I don't really know what I want to do, so I'll just get a pharmacy degree. I'll always have a job, and then I can figure out what I want to do.
You knew something about it, right?
I didn't know.
You had pharmacists who worked at the drugstore? Or?
No, just my dad and granddad were the only two, so that was it.
They were pharmacists?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay,
yeah,
so
yeah.
They were filling prescriptions?
They ran the store, they owned the store, yeah.
Yeah. So watching that, you know, they're...
Well, it must have, you know, some generated some interest. So, you know, I didn't wake up one morning and say, geez, you know, maybe I should be an accountant, and I could always get an accounting job. So I did want to go to pharmacy school. Thank goodness it was a lot easier to get into when I got in than it is now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in school, were you a good student? Did you take to it? Or
I would say I was an average student.
Uh-huh.
Yes, I was an average student. Mm-hmm. No scholastic achievements for me.
Right.
But got good enough grades to get into college, got good enough grades in college to get into pharmacy school, got good enough grades to get into grad school.
Yeah.
Probably would be a little stretch now.
Mm-hmm. Right. but your dad was a professional. Was there an expectation that you would go to college? Or?
Yeah, there was an expectation that I was going to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't wasn't exact, didn't score high marks on planning either. I remember one time when I was a senior in high school, one night at dinner, my dad said, "You're going to college, right?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Any idea how you're going to pay for it?" I said, "Nope."
Mm-hmm.
So he said, "I'll pay your undergraduate tuition,
mm-hmm.
and after that, you're on your own."
Mm-hmm.
So that was it.
Yeah. And you went to Kansas, University of Kansas, which I suppose is the big goal for everybody in the state.
Yeah, it was a big goal, you know. I guess my grades were good enough. I could have looked at other places, but, you know, I guess, admittedly, my horizons might have been a little more narrow than they should have been. So that was it. It's the only place I wanted to go.
Mm-hmm. That's a good place to be, right?
Yeah, I think the first semester's tuition check, I think, was $174.
Mm-hmm. So. But that was a lot more money in those days.
It was, but still, you know, mm-hmm. now tuition checks are considerably higher than that, even in public universities.
Yeah. So did you work your way through? Did you hold jobs? Or
a series of jobs. I mean, I worked every summer. Every summer I made enough money to basically get through the next year.
Yeah, what kind of jobs?
I ran the swimming pool in Fredonia for two summers, and then the best job in town for a kid was working at the cement plant. There was a concrete quarry, you know, you dug out the rock and you made concrete. And
it was best because of the money.
That's
you
the
could
money.
Make.
That's the, you know, I think it was like, I don't know, it was probably $4 or $5 an hour. I mean, which was spectacular back then.
Uh-huh.
So I did that for 2 years.
That's hard work.
We built the railroad track for the train that went around the quarry to haul the rocks in. Yeah. So it was hard work. Great pay,
mm-hmm.
great exercise. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you did settle on pharmacy. And
yeah.
What was the plan then? I mean, you went back for a couple of months.
When I was in pharmacy school, Eli Lilly came to interview because back then Eli Lilly only hired pharmacists, mm-hmm. and I interviewed with them, and they asked me what I wanted to do, and I said, you know, I'm thinking about getting my MBA, and they said, you do that. You go get your MBA, then you call us. So I went and got my MBA, and I called them, and they hired me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a famous guy at Lilly from Kansas, Irving Johnson. Did you?
Yeah. He was either number one or number two guy at Lilly when I was there.
In research, yeah.
Yep.
He just passed away recently.
Did he? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But you probably had no idea of who he was then.
Well, I the thing is, when I was at Lilly when I went into the home office in the late 70s, it was a much smaller organization. I was an associate, you know, I was entry-level grunt in marketing. And you would, you know, I made a couple of presentations to Gene Stapp, the president of the corporation. So, you just... Incredibly, you knew the executives. I knew Irv Johnson. Didn't have much interaction with him, but would occasionally be in a meeting with him. I mean, it probably would never happen that way now.
Yeah.
I don't think I was ever in a meeting with Dick Wood, who was the chairman, but a lot of meetings with Gene Stapp.
Yeah. Well, they said get an MBA first.
Yeah.
And you wanted to go into the pharmaceutical business.
I did. Yep. Yep. The one guy who was very influential on me was the associate dean at the pharmacy school, Hugh Cotton, who I don't think he ever worked in industry, but you know, if you were in pharmacy school at Kansas, there were two paths: retail pharmacy for like 90% of the graduates, and a pretty good research program for 10%. So there was a pretty good research track. Takaguchi was one of the, you know, great pharmaceutical chemist leaders, was at Kansas. Mm-hmm. Alex Zaffaroni actually founded Alza at Kansas, then had the good sense to move it out here. But you know, there's a lot of good pharmaceutical chemistry roots at Kansas. So if you were there, mostly retail, occasional research, but Dean Cotton, you know, he tried to expose people to consider other things. Mm-hmm. So he's the one that first started saying, hey, you know, you should think about going into industry. So that's what appealed to me.
Yeah, but you're making kind of a shift from actually doing pharmacy to the business side.
Right.
And I mean, did that come from you? Was that your idea?
That was my idea, you know. And I'm sure it was disappointing to my dad that I didn't come back. But
mm-hmm. He took back to Fredonia to work in the store and be the pharmacist.
Yeah.
But I'm sure he was pleased that you were doing well.
Yeah, he was. He obviously was very, very excited and proud that I went to Lilly, because that was, you know, that was a really great company, still is. Mm-hmm. And then early on, when I left Lilly to go to Serono, which was a startup at the time, he was very supportive, of course, but I think he was going, wow, I'm not sure I get this move. You're leaving Lilly to go to this little company I've really never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
MBA from SMU, that's interesting. How did you land there?
They had a one-year program.
Is that it?
They had a one-year program, and there was a guy I knew from Fredonia who had gone there to get his MBA, and worked out good. I would probably still advise somebody, do what everybody does. Get your undergraduate degree, go work, then go get your MBA. It probably is more impactful, but I didn't.
It would probably be better because you could get more out of the MBA.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. After you've worked and kind of seen the real world, mm-hmm. it's probably better. I had worked in drugstores. I worked when I was in, I worked, obviously, for my dad. I did an internship one summer at Marion Laboratories.
Which is Kansas City.
Before it, whatever it is now, 8 mergers later or whatever. But I wanted to get the MBA, I wanted to go into industry, but I wanted to do it quickly.
And so during the interview, Lilly comes and you're talking to them and they say, yeah, we like you, we'll come, but...
I could have gotten a job then, I think. I mean, they seemed pretty anxious to hire me, but, you know, they said, hey, you want to go get your MBA, then you might want to come work for us. We'll call us later when you got your MBA.
Yeah, okay, so you did that, and then you called them?
I called them, yep. I called them, said, I'm getting ready to graduate, and, God, I can't, I don't even remember if they interviewed me again. They said, where do you want your sales territory? So I
had you talked sales to them before?
Yeah, it's like, that's what, if you were a farm, I guess, you know, you could have gone into research, maybe, but they hired pharmacists to go into sales. That mm-hmm. was the entry level marketing position.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
So that's, so I called them, said, I think when I was, while I was in SMU, I worked for Skillern's Drug Stores, which was a chain in Dallas. I worked every weekend, every holiday, and confirmed I didn't want to do that for the rest of my career. So I called them and said, I'm getting ready to graduate. And I don't even remember them interviewing me again. They might have. But they said, where do you want your sales territory to be? And I gave them basically every southern state from California to Georgia, except for Florida. And they signed me to Jacksonville, Florida, which was fine.
And you wanted to be in the South because of the weather?
Yeah.
And why did you exclude Florida?
Oversight. Never crossed my mind.
It's a new thing. You're doing sales for Eli Lilly. What do you have to learn? What's the job entail?
Well, they sent me down to meet with the guy who would be my boss. The district manager, district office was in Atlanta, so I met with him. Then I went into initial training for whatever it's 2 weeks or maybe it's a month at Lilly. So you went in and you did initial training.
To learn about the products?
About the products and about the sales process and about Lilly policies and procedures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't ever put your detail bag on a doctor's desk. You might scratch it, so things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And did you feel prepared for this? I mean, did you feel like you knew what you were doing?
I was a kid.
I
was very excited, really. I was so excited for the job, just to be working for Lilly.
Fair amount of traveling, right? Were you driving around?
No, I mean, Jacksonville was a pretty big town. There were three Lilly reps in Jacksonville.
Really?
Yeah. So I was one of three. The other guys were older guys and mentored me very well. So that was good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What did you have to learn? What were the tricks of the trade?
Well, I really think I learned pretty early on. I guess there's no reason to edit this out. All you had to do was work hard. I mean, you just had to make the calls because it was a pretty easy job for those old guys, right? If you were with Lilly and you'd been in the territory for 15 or 20 years, you got the business. They knew the doctors.
Good products.
Yeah, good products. Absolutely. I mean, antibiotics and, just really, really good stuff. But if you worked a little harder, I found you got a little more business. So that's what I learned first, just go to work and make the calls.
So you're doing well at that, and
I guess so. I mean, Lilly had a program at the time to bring guys in from the field to kind of do a temporary assignment, and then they decide whether you would come in to a marketing job. So after 18 months in the field, I got called in on, they called it a switch assignment. So I came in, did my switch assignment.
When you say came in, that means go to Indianapolis?
Went to Indianapolis. Yep. So I flew into Indy on a Sunday afternoon from Jacksonville in 1978, I think, probably, 1978. It was the first day the airport was open after a massive snowstorm. So I flew from Jacksonville. I remember coming in. It must have been 20 below zero. We could barely get around.
Well, you used to that weather in Kansas, though.
Yeah, kind of. And so it was, I think that was probably a 2 or 3 month assignment. And then if they, if you didn't screw up, then they would invite you back in to be a marketing associate. Kind of take the next step on the career path.
And it's something you wanted to do?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was fun being in sales. I did not, I wanted my career to go up, not stay flat.
And so that's learning another kind of game, different game, marketing.
Absolutely. I was thinking about this over the weekend. I'm pretty sure my first day after my switch assignment, because I went back and looked what the key dates were. I think my first day in Lilly was the day that the Supreme Court heard the Chakrabarty argument, which was the first genetically engineered organism patent, because it was, I just remember going in and everybody was talking about it, and I was going, I have no idea what you're talking about.
So this is 1978?
I think it's 78. I went back and looked at the date over the weekend. I think that Chakrabarty went to the Supreme Court on March 17th, 1978, I think, which would have been, I think, my first day inside at Lilly.
Yeah. And Lilly is already into biotech stuff.
Well,
into molecular biology.
The buzz was, is this the future of insulin? you know, that was
right.
That was what everybody was
talking
about.
That was the number one product, insulin? That,
yeah. I think so, yeah.
Were you selling a lot of insulin in Jacksonville?
Well, no. I mean, insulin just kind of went, right?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't very competitive at the time. Lilly, I think, had most of the market.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't really promote insulin much. But it was a big product for them. But,
So that was the... It was part of the company's identity at that time already? You know, the idea that biology rather than chemistry would be important, or
yeah, because I just remember, you know, it was completely. You know, you took all that stuff in college, but here it was, right? And I was just kind of getting my head around it, and probably didn't even get my head around it at all. But just remember people talking. This might be the new way to make insulin, and no more pig pancreas.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a big day.
Yeah. So it made an impression.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you're not there long in Indy.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. But that was everything's going fine. You're doing the marketing, and
I was doing the marketing. I did like it. Two things happened. You know, one was the next logical step was go out as a sales manager. That was the next step on the career path. And I thought, wow, I don't want to do that. And then, you know, boy, I've had a lot of lucky breaks in my career. And I got a call from one of my fellow associates who had gotten a call from a recruiter about a job in Boston. And he called me and he said, guy called me about a marketing job in Boston. I don't want to go there. I gave him your name. And and then the guy called me, and I said, sure, I'll go to Boston for an interview.
Mm-hmm. What did you think you were going to find out about?
I think what I was starting to think at the time was I could be here for 20 years and wake up one morning and say, did I ever really influence a single decision? It was kind of an awakening for me as a very naive, inexperienced kid to go into these meetings and think something was going to be decided at that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when clearly that's not the expectation either. You know, for some decisions you have a series of things, and the decision has to evolve. And, I was probably immature and naive and didn't get that. But I do remember thinking, God, I wonder, I could be here for a long time and just wonder if I ever really made an impact. So went to Boston, had the interview. Remember thinking, this whole building is about the size of a conference room on the corner of the fourth floor at Lilly.
Where was it?
It was south of Boston in Serono, which at the time had really just kind of getting its legs under it in the U.S.
Yeah. Duxbury or something like that?
Bertarelli's house was in Duxbury. The offices were in Braintree.
Braintree.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So they're telling you about the company, you know, it's a Italian-Swiss company.
Right.
You'd never heard of it before.
Had never heard of it before.
And how did they present the opportunity?
The recruiter said it's a medium-sized company. He said it's a medium-sized pharmaceutical company. They need a marketing guy. He's going to run marketing. Got a couple of new products. You can build it. And I got there and the cab pulled up in front, and I remember thinking, this is not a medium-sized company.
Uh-huh.
But...
not the U.S. Counting...
No, I remember specifically, when I joined Serono, their U.S. sales were about $1 million, and their global sales were about $70 million.
Mm-hmm.
So
what was Eli Lilly at that time, by comparison?
I don't know. Probably hundreds of millions. I don't know if it was a billion then.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Hundreds of millions for sure.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I guess. I started thinking, what fun, move to Boston, see what happens, you know, see if you can make things go.
No sense of risk, really?
Still just never crossed my mind. Risk never crossed my mind at that point.
So you like Boston?
Yeah. I had gone to Boston a couple of times for Lilly, And I remember thinking, this place is really cool. And so, you know, there you were, and thinking, I could live here, I could do this. Risk never crossed my mind.
Yeah. You mentioned a couple of products. What were those? They hadn't gotten into the recombinant stuff yet.
No, but that will come later. That was pretty interesting, too. They had the gonadotropins. They had the fertility hormones. And I joined in 80. I think September, October. And I think, I should have checked this, too. I think Louise Brown, the first test tube baby, was born 3 months later. And that took off.
We'll
need to check the dates. But I think if it wasn't then, it was shortly after that. But I got there, you know, and infertility was just fledgling. They were starting to be able to monitor. They were starting to be able to visualize with ultrasound. So the multiple births thing was still a problem, but you could kind of see your way out of the problem. And then IVF hit, and it was really exciting.
Yeah, so did you realize that when you were doing the interview?
No, no. I thought this was an interesting market, and yeah, it's probably all I thought.
Mm-hmm. So that took off while you were there immediately?
Yep. The, you know, the Steptoe and Edwards first test tube baby birth in England, and then the Joneses, Howard and Georgiana Jones, were trying to slug through how to do it in the U.S., and then subsequently had the first U.S. baby, was born. Mm-hmm. It was very exciting.
Yeah, so what did that mean to you? You're the marketing director? This is the job?
Started as marketing manager. I was the only one. I was it. I was the marketing guy.
For entire U.S.?
Yeah, well, the entire U.S. was like, right. I think it was $1 million, and probably most of it, they had a diagnostic business too. Most of it was diagnostics. So there was a marketing manager for diagnostics, and then I was the marketing manager for pharmaceuticals.
Yeah. Well, even though, I mean, this is, it's not Eli Lilly, but this is a position of a fair amount of responsibility. You're still very young.
Yeah, I was very young. I mean, the guy who hired me, I don't know why he hired me.
Well, he must have thought you were serious and capable, right?
Yeah.
Is that how you would describe yourself at that time?
I was serious. I was probably capable. I was a reasonably good thinker, I guess. He was probably, Bertarelli probably told him to hire somebody, and so he was desperate to hire somebody. Coming from Eli Lilly was probably a pretty good pedigree.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So.
And did it help? I mean, what stuff that you learned at Lilly?
I mean, blocking and tackling. Blocking and tackling. What's the product? What can it do? What are the opportunities? What are the issues? So it was blocking and tackling stuff. And then they didn't have a sales force. And so I remember pitching personally to Bertarelli, we should start a sales force five people.
Yeah, this is Fabio.
Was the father.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about him. Was he there at getting this thing?
The way Bertarelli started countries, he'd send just one guy over, and just say, you go make it happen. And so he'd send a guy over who'd kind of gotten things started up, just barely, you know. And then he hired, I think they started on the diagnostic side because that was probably an easier entry. So that was kind of up and going. Then they hired a president who was, I think he'd been at Baxter, who was a legitimate executive. And he was running it when I got
there.
Jack Barlow. Jack Barlow was his name. And he had hired a head of research from Letterly, Jerry Stiles. Those guys were, you know, those were real guys.
Mm-hmm. So it was going to be a research operation from the beginning.
It was going to be pharmaceutical R&D and commercialization.
Yeah, what was the relationship between Boston and Geneva?
For a long time, it was very loose.
Pretty much independent.
Very independent. very independent. I was, you know, until really I was, God. You know, so I got there in 80. I became executive vice president and general manager in 85. President in 86, was there until 90. And really right at the end is when it started to go through what every company needs to go through, right? Every country can't run its own little fiefdom and have research and development and manufacturing and everything else. Right. And so it was pretty good when I was general manager. Mm-hmm. That would never happen now.
Yeah. Yeah. So at the beginning, you're putting together a sales force.
Yep.
And you're talking to Bertarelli about this.
I pitched it to Bertarelli. And he approved
it. What was his style? I mean, he's European and
very, very engaging personality, very idiosyncratic.
Did it strike you as different? This is something different? You know, this company's different?
Yeah, very different. It was very different from Eli Lilly. You know, very, I mean, as conventional as Lilly was, you know, when I was there, you had to put on your suit coat to walk out of your office. You can't go out in the hall without your suit coat.
Yeah.
So it was one end of convention. Serono was, it might not have been at the extreme edge of the other end, but it was mm-hmm. close. Because right? Bertarelli, you know, you could kind of do your own thing, but Bertarelli was everywhere. And if you sent him anything, he would read it and come back to you. Every single shred of paper. He'd fly over commercially then, and he'd walk into the office and he'd have a stack a foot thick, and that's what he read on the plane. And he read everything that people sent to him. Mm-hmm. So and he'd write comments on it and send it back to you.
Mm-hmm. So that's pretty impressive on the one hand. So,
yeah,
so.
Yeah. It was also very controlling.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Yeah, it was his company for sure.
Yeah. So I guess in the beginning that's probably not a big issue for you, but maybe.
No, not really. You know, I had run-ins with him throughout my career there, but so did everybody, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Got yelled at a few times.
Well, maybe you can tell me about those episodes. you got the sales force going. That was your area initially. Right?
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah.
And then there's this demand, this great demand.
It was increasing. Yeah. It was exciting just because the technology was advancing. You know, there was a way to control the ovulation induction, so you wouldn't. I mean, ovarian overstimulation was a very serious problem. That was hazardous to your health if you stimulated the ovaries. So that was a health issue for the female,
mm-hmm.
and it got so you could monitor the stimulation. So that became not as much of a problem. Mm-hmm. But multiple births were still a problem, right? And because the technique was so. Both IVF and just normal ovulation induction, it's not a very efficient process. So in order to maximize your chances, you try to get two or three or four eggs, and
mm-hmm.
you know, sometimes that doesn't work very well either.
Yeah.
Well, in the other extreme.
So, and you're explaining all of this, well, did you have to educate doctors on?
Well, there was an emerging group, right? Reproductive endocrinology was an emerging specialty, and so there were people who were kind of pioneering it. So there was the IVF side, and Steptoe and Edwards were the leaders, and then the Joneses in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were just ovulation induction people who were trying to help couples get more eggs and conceive naturally, but then they would start to move into IVF as well.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole arena was growing and I think becoming safer for sure and more efficient.
Yeah. And your customers are specialized clinics? Really?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Some of them could have been OBGYNs, but a lot of them were endocrinologists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you're having success?
Yeah.
And
yeah. having success. I think exceeded Bertarelli's expectations. I think when I pitched him the Salesforce, he was probably thinking, oh, God, I don't know.
What was your proposal? How big?
Five people.
And what was the plan? What were you going to do with those five people?
We were going to put them in metropolitan areas close to clinics, and we were going to learn what they were doing and expand it.
Well, that makes sense. Doesn't sound too extravagant.
No, it wasn't too extravagant, but, you know, I think he, I don't know what he thought, but I think we went from 5 to 9 to maybe 15 or 20 after that, so it went well. So I was hired as manager. Then it went pretty well, so then I was promoted to director of sales and marketing, not just marketing manager. So director of sales and marketing, then vice president of sales and marketing, and things were going well.
And you feel like, okay, you know the business, you got a handle on it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I think Serono was, it was my introduction to specialty marketing, and it was a small group of very specialized physicians who were dealing with very specialized products. And it wasn't easy, but
sure.
What you wanted to do was have a very good relationship with your customer. So I learned that at Serono, to have a good relationship with your customer and know
that's
what they needed and provide it to
Lily,
them.
Didn't they, you know, not the same.
Not the same.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Not the same because it's a big company, and not the same because, you know, I don't know what our initial target audience at Serono was, but it wasn't very many. I mean,
yeah.
It was in the hundreds of doctors, not the tens of thousands.
Well, the emphasis on the relationship, is that something you discovered, or is it something that Serono was already doing?
I think it evolved because there was such a common interest, because it was an emerging field. It was such an important area. I mean, this is not life and death, but it's people who wanted to have kids and couldn't. And so emotionally, it was, you know, to be able to make the patients happy was incredible. Just
yeah, these are people who otherwise couldn't have babies.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So between us and the doctors and the patients, it was a real bond,
uh-huh.
And it was joyous when you were successful.
And so you, president then is the next step?
Yeah. I think it was in Boston. I don't think he made me come to Geneva for it. I think Bertarelli, I know what it was. I had gone to Las Vegas for the weekend to see a fight. And I walked in Monday morning and Jerry Stiles had been promoted to president after Barlow, and he'd been president for a couple of years.
Uh-huh.
I walked in Monday morning, he said, Bertarelli wants to see you down the hall. So I went in, and Bertarelli said, today you are the general manager. Get yourself a bigger office. And he said he had two pieces of advice that were incredibly mundane, like get a bigger office and don't call me or something like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was it. I walked in Monday morning and Bertarelli said, you're the general manager.
Okay, so that's a whole different range of things. You
know? Yeah, yeah.
Did you feel, is that something that you wanted to do?
Yeah, it never crossed my mind. I mean, it happened. I had not had time to envision that step up. I was happy being head of sales and marketing. Things were going great.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the sales force was by then, 30, 40. It was great.
Yeah, well, that's pretty good. You're there for, what, five years, something
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, that's right. So I've been there 5 years, yeah.
Yeah, so you've done a lot in 5 years. And
Yeah. But then all those guys that were my colleagues were now working for me, and some of them were a lot older than I was.
Mm-hmm.
So it was...
Is that a challenge?
It was a challenge, yeah. Yeah, it was... Probably might have been more than a challenge than I appreciated at the time, you know, but...
Mm-hmm.
Things kept going reasonably well, so.
Yeah. Well, what else did there must have been some things you're just not familiar with, hadn't dealt with before, some aspects of.
Yeah, I mean, we were small enough that I had been exposed to everything, but when I'm sure. So when I became general manager, we had a manufacturing facility in right down the street from our offices that was that I think was for either growth hormone or the recombinant, or maybe the gonadotropins. I think gonadotropins. We had done a deal with a company that was developing recombinant gonadotropins, so we were doing research.
What,
we were doing manufacturing.
Was that?
I think it was Integrated Genetics. Is it?
Okay.
I think
Bob Carpenter's company.
Yeah, that's right. Uh-huh. Bob Carpenter's company. So we had done, Serono had done a deal with them to have them develop recombinant gonadotropins. And we'd done a deal with Celltech to do recombinant growth hormone.
Mm-hmm. And those things had been done. Had you been waiting for those products to come, or were they too far out?
Well,
when you're doing sales and marketing, are you thinking about any of that stuff?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, Bertarelli fought it as long as possible. They had a lot invested in extraction technology for growth hormone and gonadotropin. So Bertarelli really fought recombinant technology. And he was fighting it when I got there in 80, you know, it was all kind of starting.
So how did he fight it?
He wanted public relations campaign that it was a new technology, unproven, and, you know, we shouldn't go there. So it was his view. But I think right after I got there, surely within a year of when I got there, they had a corporate summit meeting in Boston. And I was assigned to do all the background work on our options of what would we make and who would be our partners. And I was thinking over the weekend, I don't know how I did it. There was no internet then. I mean, how did I get all that information?
Yeah.
But they were looking at
Do you have that report?
No. There were notebooks. Everybody got a notebook, and there were probably 20 people. It was a high level corporate meeting.
That would be an important historical document.
I don't know if they're any floating around.
Yeah.
But I did them. I made them. You know, that might have been my breakthrough with Bertarelli.
Do you recall the research that you did? What did you find out?
It was all background information. So they were evaluating gamma interferon. Should we make that with recombinant techniques? And if so, who were the vendors?
Uh-huh.
Same for gonadotropins and same for growth hormone.
Uh-huh.
And I think we even, it was a multi-day meeting, I think we even had people come in and pitch us because we had the big guys come in. Whatever they were, Cetus or, you know, I mean, there were a lot of companies that came in and pitched us. And they had selected Integrated Genetics for the gonadotropins.
Because they were local? Or?
I don't know. They were not the marquee contender, that's for sure. But there was only one vote. So, you know, 20 people in the room and one guy decided.
Mm-hmm.
So, Celltech got the growth hormone.
Is that UK?
Yeah.
Celltech, yeah.
Yep. And I think we decided maybe to pass on interferon. I can't remember the outcomes, but I...
Oh, no, I think Serono had... Wasn't there somebody in Israel working on...
Yes, that's
on
right.
On interferon?
That's
yeah.
right. That is right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was a really important meeting. Boy, I wish I had that notebook, but... You know, for each project, there were probably three or four vendors, and I had done the background information, and I think we walked out of the meeting, Bertarelli having picked people to go do a deal with.
Uh-huh, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But what was the expectation for you? I mean, you're dabbling in this, you're figuring this out, but it's not going to have a big impact on what you're doing for a while.
Precisely,
right?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, that was...
Mm-hmm.
Not my day-to-day thing at that time.
But you think that, you know, that was, that impressed, what you did impressed him enough to think,
enough.
This guy could be the next president?
I think two things impressed him. That, and he would call at all hours.
Really?
Yeah, obviously. And he would call really early in the morning sometimes, and I'd be the only guy in the office, and the office was very small, and any phone rang, you could pick it up. So he would call all the time early in the morning, and I was the only guy there, and I'd answer it, and I think he... Like
what were his concerns? He's calling.
He just called. He's calling to talk to somebody because he He might have just read a memo, and he would just pick up the phone and call him and ask him about it. No lengthy bureaucratic process, right? If he either had an idea or wanted you to do something or he had a question, he'd just call you. Mm-hmm. He called me in the middle of the night one time, and he claimed that it was the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. And I said, Fabio, it's 3 a.m. And he goes, oh, I'm so sorry. But I think I'm not sure he was sorry or not.
Did you enjoy working for him?
I did, yeah.
I mean, he sounds like a character.
He was a character, yeah. He was a real character. Just a different management style.
Uh-huh.
Just what you would think. You know, he had his clique around him in the mid-'80s. This is my view, but I'll stick with it. He became enamored with the U.S., so the fact that the U.S. was growing very rapidly was very exciting to him. He opened a satellite corporate office in Boston. He was obviously doing work with Integrated Genetics. He loved the U.S. market. He loved the U.S. So it was, it was really high on his radar screen then. I think after a while, he got tired of me and the U.S. in general, but... mm-hmm. For a while, he came over all the time. We did limited partnerships here to raise research money. He bought a gigantic ranch in Arizona.
Really?
And just, he was here all the time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And he was spending a lot of time sailing, I assume, up in...
Yeah, I don't remember that. He must have, because... Or Ernesto picked it up on his own, I don't know. Uh-huh. Yeah.
He never talked about sailing.
Not really.
Yeah.
I went to his house in Duxbury a few times, but I don't. Mm-hmm. I don't ever remember going sailing with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But he was. Would you call him challenging? Was he difficult? I mean, he's a little. Calling 3M. That's one thing. But in terms of, did he get in the way of stuff that you wanted to do or thought needed to be done or?
He was very eclectic as a manager. I remember when I went, getting ahead of myself, but as an example, I went to the UK. When I went to the UK as general manager, again, he'd give you like two pieces of advice. One of them was sell the diagnostic business. We had a lab over there. It's one thing, sell
That's
the diagnostic business.
A pretty big piece of advice.
Yeah. And so I spent a lot of time doing it. I ended up getting a price. A lot more. It wasn't a lot. I don't know whether it was 10 million or 20 million.
More than he expected.
I went in and said, okay, I've got the deal. And he said, I'll never forget, he said, I don't understand why you want to do that. We're not going to do that. Just like that.
He had said, sell it.
Sell it. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. And the first time, we did a road show in the U.S. to take the U.S. company public. And he decided the night before, not going to do it.
Hmm. So that's a little difficult. I mean, to yeah.
Yeah.
So what were you thinking just out of the blue? Okay, no, we're
yeah.
going.
I think you just kind of got used to it. That uh-huh. it was. I'd only been with Lily inside for 2 years, so I learned pretty quickly the corporate processes frustrated me, but I never really got so. I probably should have appreciated them more than I did, right? There's a pretty good way to make decisions, and I'm sure Lily had a pretty good process. I was only there for 2 years. I never really learned it. So I grew up with Bertarelli as my mentor, and so it just that's the way it was.
Well, that kind of inconsistency, did it ever make you wonder, maybe... this isn't the way to do this, and maybe this could be bad for the company?
Yeah, well, I think you always say you learn things and you learn things not to do. So, I think part of that. But, it was interesting, because, and again, it's probably not the greatest management technique. At the highest level, you kind of got to run the U.S. business. I mean, I had to go present the budget every year, but, once you got the budget approved, you kind of ran the business. So the good news is, you kind of got, at the highest level, you got to run the business. And then the stuff he killed you on was all the little detail things.
Uh-huh, yeah. But that's, you really had an opportunity to shape it. You felt like it's, you know, this is mine.
Yes, absolutely.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And who is helping you along the way? I mean, you're growing up and positions, and you're then bringing people in to help you, right?
Yep. So the when I took over as general manager, the head of R&D, the head of manufacturing, stayed. The head of finance stayed, but then transitioned out. So I replaced finance. I hired and promoted all the commercial people, regulatory people, manufacturing people.
Yeah. So you've got a lot invested.
Yeah.
In this, I mean, it's almost like this is your.
It was humming by then. Yeah, kind of the late 80s, you know, when we were doing, I don't know, 80, 100 million at the time, that was a pretty nice business.
Had the recombinant products hit by then, or did...
The recombinant products had not hit.
Yeah.
Right, had not hit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you're there till, what, 1990?
I left in 90, had... I can remember one near-death experience because part of the budget was that we were, you know, gonadotropins for a long time were a combination, FSH and LH.
Yeah.
And then the technology evolved and you really only needed follicle-stimulating hormone initially. You should give those separate, not together. So we were developing FSH. It was part of the budget. We said we were going to get approved. We said we were going to launch it. It was a critical part of the budget. Mm-hmm. Kind of got to be like November and... It hadn't gotten approved yet. And I got a call from corporate attorney. And he said, Bertarelli's going to call you into, it was like the mafia. He said, you're going to get called into Boston, you're going to get fired. And the next week we got approval. I never went to the showdown. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was that concerning you at the time? Did you think that was right? I mean, it's not the kind of thing where you can just snap your fingers and, you know, it's not like you have control of things.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't really remember other than, you know, I didn't disbelieve him. I figured his sources were good, but I don't remember worrying about it that much. You know?
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. And, but then he asked you to...
Well,
something else.
He did. Although I think it was a little bait and switch in retrospect, because what they said is, we're going to reorganize, so we're going to go to four regions, and we're looking for the four guys who are going to run, or three. I forget what it was. Uh-huh. There are going to be three regions: the Americas, Europe, and all other. And so there's going to be a new level of management created, and you should probably get some experience to do that. So I said, absolutely. Send me overseas. I want to do it. I want to get that experience. I want to be one of those guys. Because the U.S. and Italy were the two biggest affiliates by then.
Mm-hmm.
And Spain was growing rapidly. So it was kind of the Spanish general manager and me were the guys who were really making it happen. So I thought, I'm going to go do that. I'm going to get one of those jobs and off to the next step. And so I was over there for like 6 months and they named them and I wasn't one of them. So I was in London and thinking, shit. This affiliate is 20% of the one I left. Uh-huh. I came over here to get the next job, and I'm not going to get it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so what do you think's going on there?
I think Bertarelli got tired of me.
Yeah, tired of you, why in particular?
Mm.
I mean, you're there's some friction there?
Yeah, what I was told is that I was pretty visible as the U.S. general manager, and that probably didn't go over very well with him. I had a big fight with him over a new R&D position that never really got resolved.
Uh-huh.
So, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's a little difficult, and probably the first time in your career where you really hit that kind of turbulence.
A little turbulence, but then, you know, I'm not sure. I think he wanted to get me out of the U.S. Just, you know, for the record, if this is the official record, I think he wanted me out of the U.S. Because after I left, you know, there were some stories that were kind of, the story that appeared in the local paper was, didn't make budget, relieved of duty, sent, banished to the U.K. And so, yeah, some PR guy in the corporate office was responsible for that, but and he lost his job shortly after that. But he wouldn't have done that without somebody else telling him to do it.
Yeah. Well, how was the business doing? It was still...
The business was doing good. We had a big miss on the budget, and so we said we'll get it next time, and it was probably my mistake, because I thought we would get it back, and we didn't. I missed understanding the business.
Were you involved in the biotech industry is going at this time, and starting trade associations? Which, I mean, you were involved in the bio thing,
right?
A little later, were you involved in any time before that?
Yeah. I was actually let me see. The IBA was the big one, Industrial Biotechnology Association. Then there was a little one.
The ABC.
ABC.
Yeah.
And so we were always in the ABC.
Tell me about that. How did you get into it? Was Serona already part of it when you came on? I don't even know I'm not sure when that organization was established.
Well, whenever it was established, we were in pretty early on, because the IBA was really the big guys, and I don't know how we got into the ABC, but that's where we ended up. And so I ended up being the president of the ABC the year that Steve Duzan was the president of the IBA. And
So is this late 80s we're talking about?
It was probably... would have been 87, 88. Mm-hmm. And both groups realized we were really not being very effective because we were always at odds.
Do you remember some of the issues? You're president, so absolutely. What were some of the...
Well, the issues were, there are a couple of issues. One was the orphan drug law that I was a real outlier on. If you talk to Henry Tamir, he probably thinks I was the biggest jerk on the planet, because Genentech had orphan drug exclusivity for growth hormone and were blocking us, and we were going after them, and that was tough to go after them.
Well, what did you want to change?
We wanted to change the law. So we were lobbying like crazy to change the law.
In what particular aspect of it? So, I mean, you're arguing that this drug is too big to be? So what did you want to change the requirements for?
There had to be. There was
orphan designation?
There would be there would be a patient as well as a financial hurdle that you had to get over or stay under or something like that. So, that's old, very old news at the time. But there were a lot of things that the two associations were kind of at odds over.
Yeah, that's one. What were some of the other issues?
I don't remember. I really don't remember what the others were. Have you interviewed Kirk Robb yet?
I haven't interviewed him.
Henry Tremere would know. Kirk would know. Carl Feldbaum came on after that. He came on when we merged.
So I
don't know who would know the issues, but it was whatever. It was a big company, small company thing, and we thought we were getting crushed, and they thought it wasn't working, and so we weren't getting anything done because we were always fighting. And so
from your point of view, that was bad in Washington too. The fact that you didn't have there's no sort of solidarity here in the industries, and you felt that it was not just the competition there, but the fact that it was interfering with getting stuff done in Washington.
Yeah, and at the same time, I didn't agree with the IBA's position on the orphan drug thing. There was a rising awareness that two voices were bad. One voice would be a lot better. Geez, I don't know. I don't know how I got tagged to do it. I was president at the time. It's probably a miracle it got done, because Steve Duzan and I had plenty of, not pleasant conversations about how it was going to come together. But we,
you guys are battling.
How's it going to look and structure? I mean, God, I can't believe we negotiated that. But I think it was pretty much Steve and I, and then I had a committee that was very good that helped me, because I remember we were going to take it to a vote one time, and I was going to do it, and Mitch Sayer and a couple of other guys said, "Don't do it. You cannot go yet. It's too early. You are going to lose, and it's going to be a setback, and don't do it." And we didn't do it. They were right. We took another run at it, and we got it teed up, so it was ready to go. And the wild card was Kirk Robb. And I went to the IBA meeting, annual meeting, and when Duzan introduced it, Kirk stood up and said, "I second the motion."
So he was at Genentech by that time.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And so that
did it.
That did it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was great.
Mm-hmm.
There were people in it was, well, I was going to say there were, it was tougher for the ABC because there were some members who didn't think we should merge, that we would just be subsumed, and you know, that was what I had to fight against, was the people saying, if we do this merger, the little companies will never have a voice. That was what I had to control on my side. And Steve Duzan, I'm sure, had to control on his side the big companies going, "Why do we need these guys? This is just an incredible annoyance."
Mm-hmm.
So,
but
it worked.
Yeah, do you think Serono was, I mean, it was just a historical accident that you're in the ABC? Because it's actually a pretty big company by that time.
Right? Yeah.
Doesn't really fit with the others?
I think, as I recall, I can't even remember the specifics, I think I was probably closer to the organizers of the ABC when they started it up.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember the first ABC annual meeting, but it had 20 people there. There was nobody. I mean, it was just so. I hung with a group. We were invited to join that. We started it up. It grew very rapidly. The last ABC convention before the merger was in North Carolina. It had probably 1,000 people there. And you know, it was mm-hmm. rocking by that time. So I think the IBA was going, "God, look at all those little companies. At least they have a pretty big meeting."
Mm-hmm.
So that was good. But just started out with the ABC, and I think once you cast your lot back then, you didn't cross the fence.
Yeah.
So
you put them together to take a while. Were you involved in sort of working that out beyond that point, or?
Once it was done, then there was a search committee that I was on that hired Carl Fellbaum. That one of the solutions to the big versus small thing was the emerging companies section, which is still part of Bio. So mm-hmm. I was on that, and I think I was on the executive committee of Bio for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
So and it worked well, I think.
Yeah. And Carl was not a universally, there wasn't unanimous agreement that he was the right guy, right?
Right, right. But there were a couple of people, and I can't remember who they were. Honestly, I can't mm-hmm. remember who they were. But a couple of very powerful people thought he was absolutely the right guy. Mm-hmm. And so that's what carried the day.
Yeah, what was your feeling on
that? Mixed. Carl, sorry.
And he was a Washington guy,
Washington,
right? So that's on his side. But then the argument against is that he doesn't know the pharmaceutical industry, or mm-hmm.
yeah, or the biotech industry.
Yeah,
that
right,
was
right.
Even the IBA. I think the IBA probably, I could be proven wrong. I think the IBA might have had a couple of big pharma companies then, but not really, right? Pharma was pharma,
right,
and IBA was big biotech.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And so it was very different.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think the feeling was, you know, this guy isn't Washington insider, but he has no biotech.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a couple of people who thought he was the right guy, and they prevailed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you're in London, is that what,
right?
In 1992, are those the years?
Right, 1992. Yeah.
And what did happen to the diagnostics portion of that? Did it not go anywhere? Did it or did it stay?
Our little lab didn't go anywhere. It was still there when I left, and Serono ended up selling its diagnostic business. Mm-hmm. Yeah, after I left.
Yeah. Okay. So that's that's the end of your time with Serono. You're stuck there, right?
I'm stuck there.
So
yeah. Another thing you always should negotiate: under what circumstances you get brought back, right? Even mm-hmm. if it's just a one-way ticket back. But I had not negotiated that part.
Yeah.
So I was over there in no man's land.
Yeah, so what are your thoughts at that point?
Well, again, kind of lucky. Before I even thought about, am I stuck here, right? Every day that goes by, I become less remembered in the U.S. And I remember one guy telling me that. He said, you got to get back soon, a year from now. People are going to be looking for people for jobs, and they're not going to be thinking of you. But before that really sunk in, Seth Rudnick called me and asked me if I'd be interested in working with him at a cell transplantation company.
Yeah, and he was in Boston?
He was in Providence, Rhode Island, yeah. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, when he was at J&J, I had tried to hire him at Serono. Couldn't do it, but we kind of developed a good rapport. And so then he called me and said, you want to be the business guy for my new company.
Yeah, so I did. So this is something, again, this is something completely different, right? This is a real startup?
Yeah, it was a real start, pre-IPO.
Yeah, and I guess by that time, there were lots of biotech startups around, but it's still, what was your perception of it?
Yeah, it's funny. I hung around with all of those guys, but I don't think I was part of the startup culture. I just hadn't done it. It was, mm-hmm. I was more of a pharma guy, I guess. It's yeah. funny. I was hanging around with them, but nobody ever called me and asked me if I wanted to do a startup. Nobody called me and asked me if I wanted to go be with a startup until Seth.
Yeah, so it wasn't part of your image then, I guess.
I was more of a pharma guy.
Uh-huh. And did you, I mean, were you thinking in those terms?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think so. For as much as I've enjoyed being an entrepreneur since then, I wasn't an entrepreneur then. Although Serono was an entrepreneurial experience when I got there. It was 10 people and $1 million, and we grew it, and it was a blast. And that's when I said I will never go back and work for a big pharma again.
Right. So were you thinking this is a chance to do that again?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. At that point, again, I wasn't thinking risk, but I was thinking we could, Seth and I can make this great.
So you thought, well, tell me about the company and what, where it was at that time and funding and the whole thing.
It was a pre-IPO.
Tell me about the initially. How did it? Literally, he called you up and.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. Or maybe it was a recruiter. I don't know how I was contacted, but Seth and I had known each other. I still have a lot of respect for him. And so he said, you want to come over and talk about this job? So I did. And, the technology was intriguing, right? You engineer cells and implant them for Parkinson's disease and diabetes. It's
These are not stem cells.
Nope, they're not stem cells. They are probably harvested, purified cells. I don't think they were genetically engineered.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, one of the holy grails that remains. So.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Interesting idea.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And then, in fact, just to jump ahead, I got there. I was there for a couple of years, and that's where I ended up was interesting idea. I'm wondering whether my grandkids will ever see this technology commercialized. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, well, things are, it takes a long time to do anything. And,
right.
And it's hard to tell just how far off it is, but this is a time of great optimism.
Yes, yeah, very, very exciting. Yeah, and to be in the, kind of on the cutting edge and hanging around with those scientists, yeah, it was great.
Yeah, so, what shape was the company in initially? Was there a company there, or is it really literally you're choosing the wastebasket?
No, there were probably 20 or 30 people there. Seth, I think, had come. It was actually up and running. Seth took it over.
Okay.
So he was the second CEO, I think. So it was up and running.
Yeah, where did the money come from for that?
Mayfield.
Uh-huh. Where it was out here?
Providence.
It was in Providence?
Yep.
Okay.
So we just did a round trip, moved back to Boston, and I commuted down to Providence every day. So we were back in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And enjoyed working with the team. Started to wonder about the technology. I started pitching the board on a diversified strategy of going back to my roots, and they were probably going, this doesn't make any sense at all. But I started pitching them on, let's bring in some commercial products. Let's start a company here.
Uh-huh.
And then we can do the research, but we'll have a real company. And I don't think the board liked that.
Mm-hmm. They had faith in the technology?
Yeah, I think, they were in the, we are going to make this work and this is going to be huge, or it's not, and, that's
yeah.
the way we operate.
Mm-hmm. And it's, Seth is committed to the technology
yeah.
as well?
Yeah, Seth was committed to the technology.
And what was the hang-up was you couldn't get it into clinical trials or didn't perform in clinical trials?
Yeah, it was because they were non-human cells. You had to have them encapsulated
yeah.
in a very fine environment, right? You had to have enough oxygen and nutrients that they don't die, but you can't have them very exposed to the immune system either.
Uh-huh.
So that was...
Were there any regulatory issues, special?
Yeah, well, I don't think we ever got to the clinic,
yeah,
so...
Okay.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Yeah, right. I'm sure there were after I left, but mm-hmm. we were still trying to make it work in animals when I left,
uh-huh.
trying to get the rats to not exhibit Parkinsonian behavior.
Mm-hmm. So that one, that nice try, but
yep.
it didn't go.
And again, I think about the time I was thinking, I like companies with a better chance of getting commercial than this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the board was probably thinking, this guy wants to go commercial here. He just does not get what we're all in it for.
Mm-hmm.
And coincidentally, I got a call about a startup in California. The recruiter was the wife of one of our board members, and I'm not sure it was coincidence. Mm-hmm. They were probably going to get this guy out of here. So,
mm-hmm.
came out.
So this is Kinetics.
This was Kinetics.
Mm-hmm.
Connective Therapeutics.
All right, and what was the situation then, 1994?
Kinetics had a product called Relaxin that they were looking at for scleroderma, which was a terrible disease and easy to get excited about. Boy, what a difference that would make. Serono actually had tried to develop Relaxin for a different indication. So when they said, "Hey, we got a new indication for Relaxin," I remembered Relaxin.
So it's a biologic. Is this a hormone?
It was extracted, but the Relaxin from Connective Therapeutics was a genetically engineered hormone from Genentech. That Genentech had tried for an indication, it had failed. They had spun it out, and so here was opportunity number two
mm-hmm.
that I thought, God, let's go to California, let's try it. So at that point, I think I had kind of moved into, hey, that's where the action is, let's try it out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And my wife was going, boy, I never wanted to live in California. Do we really want to do this?
She didn't like California?
She does now.
Yeah.
Yeah, she loves it now. But we liked Boston. Boston was a great place,
Mm-hmm.
If you grew up in Kansas and then lived in Boston, you just don't know any better, right? That's just the way the weather is.
Mm-hmm.
It's always shitty.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. but she, bless her heart, she supported us. She came out here. Mm-hmm. We had two little kids and we came out here.
Yeah. And did you think this opportunity was going to be a lot different than cytotherapeutics, that there's a real chance for commercialization, or that
yes.
was the focus?
Yes. Well, and we had a board who included Gene Bauer, who we still work together to this day, and we had a board who was open-minded about, hey, we've got a product, we see a path to commercialization, it would be good to actually pre-build commercial activities before we do that. Some companies were trying that at the time. I'm not sure anybody ever did it very well, but it was a possibility at the time. So it just, you know, it was an opportunity to try it, and you know, the investors were very excited. They claimed they were very excited about me coming out. One of them said, you know, the most talented guy that's ever not been the CEO of a biotech startup. But I said, geez, I hope you're saying that a year from now. So they recruited me and came out, and it was great.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Not without its catastrophes. I mean, we had, you know, really spectacular product failures.
Yeah, well, this is a classic biotech story, right?
Yeah, the Stanford case. I'm very proud of the Stanford case about near-death experiences, how the Relaxin trial failed and, you know, kind of rebuilt the company.
Go ahead, tell me about it.
Well, you know, the when I got here, we had three technologies. One was just, you know, it was pretty easy to see that's not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. Then there was gamma interferon from Genentech for atopic dermatitis. I think it was. Mm-hmm.
What was it? What was it? There was a Genentech connection here.
Yeah, it was. So the two founders were Ed Amento, who was a scientist at Genentech, and when these programs got deprioritized, he asked to spin them out. So Ed Amento and Gene Bauer. And Gene Bauer had actually treated a patient at Stanford with scleroderma with Relaxin, and they thought they saw therapeutic activity. So, you know, two really good scientists, a great mission, mm-hmm. and, you know, really, you know, just a great time to think about making a difference for some patients that are really in tough shape.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did a great job of executing two colossal product failures. So gamma interferon failed first, and then Relaxin failed in spectacular fashion.
When you say spectacular, is this like phase three, approaching?
Yeah. Phase three, you know, huge run-up on the stock, closed at 27 on Friday, made the announcement on Sunday, opened at 6 on Monday. I mean, just terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible. Unwinding the clinical trial, telling patients that there was no evidence of activity.
Yeah, so, I mean, these are hard days.
Yeah.
In the business, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, what's that experience like, to just see the whole thing just go?
Yeah, it was, you know, you just, and on one hand, you do it, you know, you're probably, well, my experience was, because we had plenty of others after that, at the time, I just remember doing it, you know, this is really crappy, and you just do it. You just have to do it. You know, once there's a little space between just doing it and then actually thinking about it afterwards, it's even harder. But, you know, I remember, you know, you talk to investors, you talk to employees, you talk to investigators for Relaxin. It was tough. But, you know, what we had done is, and this is kind of the subject of the Stanford case, what we had done is the board had agreed to go ahead, assuming Relaxin works and dermatologists was one of our targets, we could go ahead and build a pre-commercial business. So we actually had one product on the market and selling it, and had just gotten the approval for a second product to launch. And so the decision that we had to make was, do we go back and keep working on Relaxin? Maybe at the expense of the derm business, do we try to sell those products, monetize them, and invest it in Relaxin? Do we just focus on the derm business, or do we do both? And in typical fashion, we went to the board and said, let's keep doing both. And about a week later, one of the directors called me and said, you know, the board agreed to do both, but I would just ask you to think about it. And so I did, and we came to the decision to jettison Relaxin, focus on the derm business, mm-hmm. which was, you know, great.
Yeah.
So we went from like 7 million to 200 million.
Yeah. And, well, what were you giving up there, the possibility of it's a really huge
thing. Yeah, we were giving up the possibility that we could make it work. You know, kind of walking away from a patient population that needs a therapy.
Right.
So,
but
it was tough.
But you're following, I mean, you've developed commercial instincts, right? This is the way to run the company.
Yeah, you got
the right
it.
Thing
you know,
for
you,
the company.
Yeah, you got it. You know, the first, well, yeah, you look at all the factors. And I think on, you know, the interesting thing, Relaxin ended up and is in, currently in the hands of Novartis, because what we did see in the clinical trial was no effect on scleroderma, but we saw vascular, cardiovascular changes that were kind of interesting. We couldn't have pursued them because, you know, that was multi-hundred-million-dollar development program, and we could have never done that, and we couldn't have financed it. Mm-hmm. So we took the small ball approach and grew the derm business, and you know that turned out okay. And there was a great phase 2 clinical trial on Relaxin. Novartis tried to get it approved with a single phase 3 trial. The FDA rejected it. I hope I live to see the day that Relaxin will eventually make it to the market.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And where did it go first?
So Genentech to us, us to a company called Bass Medical, which was looking at it because the thought was, well, if it remodels connective tissue, could you use it to improve the efficiency of Visalign, or you know the braces you put in, rather than having braces, you use these things to kind of move your teeth. And so somebody said, hey, if it remodels collagen and connective tissue, maybe that'll work better. Mm-hmm. It did not. Then it went to a company that focused on the cardiovascular benefits that got great phase 2 data, and Novartis bought the company.
Mm-hmm.
So,
An interesting molecule.
And very interesting molecule. A book, you should write a book on that.
Yeah.
I would love to have a book written on that. I mean, that
it's a good
the
idea.
Twists and turns of that story, I swear, is the best in the industry.
You know, it'll become a good book if it gets approved.
It gets approved.
Yeah.
And you,
I keep an eye on it.
There are three people who will, at for absolutely no financial anything, will give you all the support you need to write that book. And
you,
it would be great.
You and
Dr. Bauer and one of the other scientists.
Yeah. Okay.
The twists and turns. I mean the stories, if we could find somebody at Serono, when Serono had it, they were developing it and they killed it because it failed in an assay and they got the wrong cells for the assay. And I mean, just, it is unbelievable, that story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good to know.
It's magnificent. So I hope it gets approved.
Well, yeah, okay.
So Novartis, we could find out, are they doing another study? They tried to really get expedited approval in the U.S. and probably should have, but the FDA said no. So if they do one more study, maybe they'll get it approved, because it really is a great drug for heart failure.
Hmm. Okay.
Lowers blood pressure without increasing kidney problems, which was an observation we made in the scleroderma trial. But didn't have the resources to develop it.
Yeah. So whose decision was it actually to?
We went back to the board.
When you say we.
So after I talked to John, the board member, we took it back to the board and said, we have a modified strategy. Let's focus on the derm business.
Mm-hmm. I mean, was this really your decision?
I remember. In retrospect, was it a subtle threat? I mean, was he saying, hey, the board voted to keep going on both, but I'm telling you, they don't like it? Or was he just saying, you know, I would just ask you to rethink? I don't know what he was telling me, but I did rethink, and we made the right call.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So where did the other products come from? You had two. Yeah.
We had two. These were the foam products that Kinetics came out with. We put dermatology products in a foam delivery system. Mm-hmm. And the reason we were kind of looking for derm products. How can we build a commercial group to get ready to sell our real products? products. So we'd been looking. But the way we found this is our business development guy was walking down St. James Street in London on another deal and ran into a guy he knew who said, I'm representing an Australian company. They've got this interesting technology. Would you guys be interested? And he brought it to the board, and the board went collectively, including me, I don't really think so. And Gene Bauer was the guy who said, you guys don't understand. This will be a great delivery vehicle for dermatologists. So that's how we got it. I mean, it was, ran into a guy on the street. That's how we found it.
Yeah, and Gene was right about
that. Gene was right about it.
And it was, what's his background?
He's a dermatologist. He was chairman of Stanford when he founded Kinetics, then became the dean of the medical school. Mm-hmm. So, and the board said, hey, if Gene Bauer thinks it's good, let's do it. And so we got it. And so we licensed that product, then we licensed another product, then we licensed all of the technology, and then we ended up buying the company. So we bought the Australian company, and they were cranking out foam products. And if I had a dollar for everybody that came up to me and said, I can't believe we didn't think of a foam delivery system, I would have a lot of money. But it's one of those things, right? You know, nobody had thought of it, and it worked great.
Mm-hmm. So for you personally, this is a great success, right?
Kinetics.
So 12 years later, it's a... Yeah,
yeah, because... So I got there in 94 mm-hmm. into Kinetics. We took it public in around 97. Launched the Derm around 2000, you know, failed with Relaxin in 2001 or 2, I think, and then built a business and sold the company.
Yeah, and it was a pretty big company by the time.
Yeah, 200 million in revenue and 400 employees.
Yeah.
And I think a really good reputation in the Derm space. Mm-hmm. Back to my Serono customer service experience, you know, there aren't a lot of dermatologists, but, you know, it's a good group to interact with. Mm-hmm. And they don't have a lot of companies bringing them new products, and it's good when you can.
Mm-hmm. And this was a good product to have, right? It was
great. So, yeah, I mean, we had two foam steroids, a foam antifungal, a foam antibiotic, and patients loved it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was great.
Mm-hmm. So, 2006, tell me about selling the company. How did that come about?
We had the stock had dipped, and we got an unsolicited offer, and you know how those end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
were you trying to fight it?
Yeah. I mean, we fought it in that what you usually do. You go see if anybody will pay you more, and you tell them you're not for sale. That's what everybody does. So it's not like I'm saying anything. You do a market check. You see if you can find anybody to sell more, and you tell the person who bid in the first place it's not nearly enough, and try to get them to offer more. Mm-hmm. And we got him up a couple of bucks, I think, on the share price, and sold the company.
Mm-hmm. So it's another fork in the road for you,
right?
At that point, but you this time it's different. You've got a success to,
right?
Yeah,
right.
So what was your plan?
We closed the deal on December 28th, my 55th birthday, and when we moved to California, at the insistence of somebody that I don't even know why we did this, we had no money, but they said you should meet with a financial advisor. And the financial advisor said, what's your goal? And I said, I want to retire when I'm 55.
Did you?
No, but we closed on my 55th birthday, and I got the call. I was playing golf with Leon Panetta at Spyglass.
Leon Panetta?
He was on our board. He was on our board at Kinetics. Okay. So we were playing golf, and they called me and said the deal was closed, and I said, I achieved my goal. I could retire now if I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And started immediately looking around to do the next thing.
Yeah.
And
you never really considered retiring?
No, like 2 days later, I'm upstairs in our office and my wife comes in and she says, you know, this is usually the time I'm in this office. What are you doing here?
Oh, I meant to ask about your wife, because it's kind of interesting. She's got a nursing degree, then an MBA.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, we met at Serono.
Did you?
Yeah. We met at Serono. She was in regulatory affairs. And we met because she wanted to get into marketing. So she was bugging me about getting into marketing, and that's how we met.
Uh-huh. Okay. It's interesting that I don't, you know, a nursing degree and then an MBA, it's kind of unusual.
Yeah, she was in regulatory affairs. She'd also been a clinical trial associate, so, you know, nursing degree kind of in the, CRA, then into regulatory affairs. But she really wanted to get into sales and marketing. And she wanted to get into sales and marketing, she claimed, in the first place, because she went to see her brother in Arizona, and when she got off the plane, there was this banner that said, "Welcome Serono Sales Meeting," and she said, "You guys are down in Arizona in the middle of the winter. I want to do that."
Mm-hmm.
So, but as it turns out, she got her MBA. She was a great sales rep for GSK and went into did a little marketing for them before we had a family.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. I see.
She's very, very accomplished in her own right.
Yeah, so she understands what you're doing.
Yes, right? Yes, she does. I think she understands it. She appreciates it. She puts up with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So you do have an opportunity to take your time, find the right thing, and
And I really didn't have any idea what I wanted to do. I really didn't. You know, kind of probably defaulting towards, well, I'll just do that again, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've been so lucky, and I got I was lucky again because MPM was bugging me to join the board of Peplin, and I didn't really want to. But then they got phase 2 data that were really good, I thought, really good data. And so I said, okay, I'll join the board. But the interesting thing was we had looked at that product at Kinetics, and the team did all the work on it, and they recommended that we license it, and I turned it down. I rarely overruled a very strong recommendation, and you can ask people who were there. I said, no, we're not going to do it. Thank God. So it was still available, and they asked me to be chairman, and then chairman for a year. They asked me to be CEO, and I was CEO for a year. And it was a really, really good product, just a paradigm change for pre-cancer skin conditions. And Leo bought us.
Mm-hmm. Did you have the same? How big was the company when you joined?
It was pretty small. It was started in Australia, so they had redomiciled to the U.S., but it was still traded on the ASX. For a year I went to Australia every year, a month or two. Went down and met with investors. Went down and visited the company.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty small. There were probably 20 people here and 30 or 40 people there,
mm-hmm.
Including 20 people in manufacturing down there.
Yeah.
So
it's a small group to get an FDA approval. Yeah.
Well, we got it through phase 2 and maybe the first phase 3 study. I forget. Yeah, it was a good group. We got it through phase 2 and maybe into phase 3.
Mm-hmm.
And the investors wanted to sell, so we conducted an auction. And
you were CEO at that time?
I was CEO at
the
time.
So you negotiated?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And Leo came in really at the last moment. We had talked to them about licensing it. They came in at the last minute and said they decided they'd rather buy it than license it and cut a deal with them. So
mm-hmm.
I think it was a great deal for them. It's approved around the world now.
Yeah.
I'm very happy for him.
Well, tell me a little bit about MPM wanted you in. I mean, what was the connection there? How did they were bugging you to get into it?
They, I think based on my derm experience, they wanted to get me involved. So they wanted me to go on the board. I assume, you know, we'd just been through a sale process, and they said, hey, maybe this is going to go through a sale process someday. That's probably useful. Rolodex to have. So I think that's probably why
They
were looking at exit strategies.
Yeah, were there discussions about that?
About exiting?
Well,
a little bit, because one of the things in my contract was, which was public in Australia, does not go over well with Australian investors, was that I'd get a $500,000 bonus if I sold the company within a certain amount of time, which, I mean, a lot more than that on the stock, of course, but they, you know, I was viewed as the guy who was coming in just to sell the company by the Australian investors.
So that's 2009?
But 2000, yeah, so we sold. Kinetics closed in the end of December 2006. I think I must have gone on the board of 2007. I went on the board of Peplo in 2007, became CEO in 2008, sold it in November of 2009.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So that's, you know, you're not ready to quit yet.
No.
Right?
No.
So looking for another opportunity to do what?
Well, at that time, I was seriously thinking about going back to Kansas and running for office.
Tell me about that.
So I had been talking to people very informally for a long time about it back there, and I was going to say encouraged to do so, but probably just people being nice, saying, "Hey, if you want to do that, fine."
Well, let me ask you this. Maybe we could do a history of your political activity, or because going way back in school, right? I have the notes here.
Well, yeah.
The Senate, right?
Student Senate, president of the fraternity. I'm not sure that qualifies you to be governor, but
It's a leadership position, right?
You're doing
stuff, and then, you know, doing the trade association, which is
And I must say, when I was with the Trade Association, going back to Washington and doing that stuff, I really liked that.
Yeah.
Really, yeah.
What
I
did
really
you like
liked
about
that.
It?
Well, it's just, you know, that's where the decisions are made. That's where the action is. That's where things happen. That's where, you know. So it was very exciting.
And who were you talking to when you went back there?
To Washington.
To Washington at that time.
Ted Kennedy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Henry Waxman. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those were the healthcare guys. About the orphan drug stuff. But just, you know, bio would have lobbying days, and you'd go in and you'd talk about biotech issues. So I got to do that as well.
Well, yeah. Can you recall some of those conversations? I mean, what were you trying? What was you're trying to accomplish something there? And, you know, these guys have their constituents. They've got their thing. How did you sort of approach that? Was that a learning experience, figuring out how all that worked? Or?
Yeah, I mean yes, it is. I mean, you know, on one hand, it's the great democracy, right? You go in and say things that you think are hopefully in the best interests of the country, although they're generally in the best interest of you and then the country. But, you know, that part is very exciting. You're trying to do the right thing. And then the other side of it is, you know, you're going in lobbying for all the special interests, including biotech, right? Tax breaks and R&D credits and things like that you think are the right thing for the industry, but you're lobbying, you're talking about things that are important to the industry.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just in practical terms about how to have success at doing that. I mean, there's the old phrase, you know, to talk about lawmaking. It's like, you know, it's like, make me sausage, you don't want to know.
Right. Well, but it's, you know, it is based on the greater good, right? So you think, you know, it creates jobs, it expands the economy, the U.S. is a leader in this technology. I mean, all of those things are very true, and that's what you try to emphasize. So it was fun. You know, it's an industry that I feel very fortunate to be part of, and we did a lot of good things for patients and everybody else. So it was easy to go in and talk to those guys about what's good about biotechnology.
Yeah, It's easy to say the words, but then it's not so easy to convince them, right? Or sometimes...
Well, I mean, if you're passionate about it, you're going and saying, I think you should do this because here are the benefits.
Yeah.
And
if you go in and you're talking to Henry Waxman, you say, here are the benefits, and then he says, yeah, but...
Yeah. Well, I generally recall it usually going... Well, it very rarely you go in and make all your points, and they go, that's awesome, I'm on board, right? That, they don't say that very often. They usually tell you what they don't like about it, but you try to eventually persuade them that the good outweighs the other side. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you really enjoyed that process.
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So back then, this is the late 80s you're doing this. Yeah.
Right.
So you're thinking even then that politics is something that...
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
So you're maybe thinking possibilities. When did it first cross your mind to seriously, you know, to run for office or to get involved in some way?
Yeah, probably after Kinetics was sold. And then all of a sudden...
then you could afford
to do it. You're just stacking up, okay, what do I want to do next? I mean, it is, you know, then it's really open season. You can say, what do you want to do next? And so I started thinking about it. At that point, what did I want to do next? Which was part of the dilemma with the MPM thing, because I remember talking to my wife then, after Kinetics was sold, and said, you know, I'm thinking about moving back to Kansas and running for office. And she said, okay, if you do that, I'll support you. Uh-huh. So that was right after Kinetics was sold.
Yes.
But then I started talking to MPM, and MPM said, how about this? And so I kind of was parallel processing for a while.
Mm-hmm. And what did you want to do in Kansas? Want to go back and
yeah?
I mean, you mentioned governor, but was that initially? Was that?
It was.
That's a pretty big.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It's, you know, no city council first for me, right?
Oh.
Yeah. I originally was thinking about running for the Senate because I just thought, you know, that would have more of an impact on what I was used to doing, you know, kind of national policy and health care and things like that. So that's what I was thinking. And then it just, you know, things kind of sorted out differently. And, you know, I would say I'm a moderate to even slightly conservative, and you can be a Democrat in Kansas that way. I could probably be a Republican here in California, but I couldn't be a Republican in Kansas, so I ran as a Democrat.
Uh-huh.
And it's a tough place to... A tough place to run as a Democrat for senator, so the race started shaping up differently, and the people I was talking to asked me if I'd consider running for governor, so I did.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I evaluated it.
Yeah,
I announced, and I was in the race for a while.
Yeah, so this is a completely different kind of life, campaigning for political office. Did you know what you were getting into? Or
I thought I was, but I didn't. I didn't know. Yeah. I learned a lot what to do. I learned a whole lot of what not to do. I don't think I'll ever do it again, but I've never minded raising money for my companies. I despised raising money for myself. I hated it. Really hard.
Yeah.
So.
And then, I mean,
you know, I thought you'd walk in and go, okay, let's start the policy meetings. And they all said, no, you go in that room and you start making calls for money.
Mm-hmm. Didn't like that.
Yeah. Didn't like that. So that didn't cut my way. I was led to believe that it was a couple of $1 million to run the race, and then it quickly became $10 million to beat Sam Brownback.
Uh-huh.
And they were pretty good at really getting way ahead of me on the bad news front. So some of the litigation I'd been involved with Kinetics and other things, you know, front page right out of the gate. So uh-huh. they got me right out of the gate.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah, it's a dirty business.
And I don't blame that part, but it was. You know, again, if I would do it over again, there's a lot of ways to prepare, and I didn't prepare very well.
Uh-huh. But you don't think you'll be doing that?
As I cannot foresee such a circumstance at the present time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that's a, you know, that's...
I became a fan, you know, I've always thought the notion of publicly financed campaigns as abhorrent until I was in it. And I actually think publicly financed campaigns would be a good idea, because the money that's in politics right now, everybody knows is bad. Uh-huh. And then when you actually participate in it,
it's worse.
It's just orders of magnitude worse.
Yeah.
Very bad. Mm-hmm.
Well, let me ask you about, let's talk about Dermira.
Yeah.
And so you tried that this is coming out of this, then?
Yeah, so, you know, I lasted a couple of months in the race before I blew up. And so now I'm back here in California trying to figure out what to do next.
And you have lots of opportunities, I assume.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't very long. I was just kind of thinking about what do I do next. And before I could think about it very much, Fred Craves called and said, hey, you want to come in and just hang around Bay City and look for opportunities? So
that sounded pretty good.
Yeah, it sounded like something to do. Yeah.
So you then saw some deals coming through, right? That you could. How many came through before?
Before we picked the first one.
Yeah.
Over 100. I mean, it was. Gene Bauer and I were up there in a conference room, just looking at deals and processing stuff, and mm-hmm. you know, seeing what we wanted to do, and the first deal we did, we had both looked at independently. Just in other lives, because you know people would call us and bounce ideas off of us, and so this opportunity had been bounced off both of us, and we both passed on it. And then one of our advisors that I have a lot of confidence in from Kinetics days called me one day and said, you know, I know you took a look at this. I would advise you take another look at it. So we went back, looked at it, liked the science, decided that was the first thing we were going to do, and Bay City and NEA, and got behind it, and mm-hmm. that's how it started.
Yeah, so what did you do? Did you have know what your role was going to be, or did you have an idea that you wanted to? You
know? Yeah, I think our mission, Gene and I did agree strongly that, and this is our stated mission, we think dermatology has been underserved.
Were all these deals you're looking at in dermatology?
Yeah, uh-huh. that's what we're going to focus on. Dermatology, and it had to be unique. It was no more run-of-the-mill reformulation stuff.
You're looking for another new delivery.
Well, we were looking for new molecules. We were looking for new molecules. It's earlier and it's riskier, but there hasn't been anything new in dermatology in a long time, and patients deserve better than that. So that was the mission. And we found this stuff, and then we found a program that was an old Kinetics program that GSK, you know, the company that bought Kinetics got sold to GSK. GSK had kind of put this on the shelf. We got that back, and then we got the UCB deal, and then, you know, kind of, it came together a lot quicker than we would have thought.
Yeah, well tell me, the deal came to you, and what was there? Just the science? Just the...
There were three preclinical assets. Two products for acne, and a product of an anti-inflammatory product. And we liked the science. We thought it was work that was done at QLT. It was medicinal chemistry. It was very well done. We liked the data. Probably is, you know, you just don't see a lot of good stuff in dermatology that you thought uh-huh. very interesting, very innovative. We liked it. And so we got it.
Mm-hmm. So. And were you ready to be operational? Officer.
Well,
again.
I didn't. I thought it might be a little different to start with. I thought it would be. There is a real scarcity of good dermatology products. And so I think both of us kind of started out thinking we would do ourselves and dermatologists and their patients a favor by getting something to proof of concept, and if it works, we could sell it and everybody wins. Mm-hmm. But I think the void in the market, the opportunity, the people we've been able to hire, I think has kind of inspired us that, you know, go big again.
Okay.
Bigger than ever. Why not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is 5 years down the road now.
This was 5 years. It'll be 5 years this August when we close the Series A.
Mm-hmm. And you've got, I'm looking at four molecules and got one in phase three. Oh, but that's
Cimzia.
Yeah.
Cimzia's in phase three, and we have one in phase two, and we have one that we believe will be in phase three the second half of this year. Mm-hmm. So that's the goal this year. Two phase three, one phase two.
Yeah, so far so good, huh?
Yeah.
How big is the company?
45 people.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So you're having fun?
I am. I'm having... How many people have you talked to that said they wish they'd done something else?
Yeah, I can't think of any, but yeah. Yeah, no, but there's something about it, right?
There is. There's something about working in this business that you really help people, and everybody you're working with is doing it to help people. So I'm sure there's somebody out there, but out of 180 people so far, you haven't found anybody that said, I wish I had a different career.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think anybody said that.
Yeah, so I consider myself very lucky at the outset to be doing this. And then I was able to, you know, point out a couple of things that just were pure luck. That guy called me at Lilly. I mean, and he only called me because the guy he called turned the job down because he didn't want to move to Boston. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, very, very fortunate. Even here, I mean, Gene and I both passed on the first deal, and Dr. Webster called us independently and said, if I were you guys, I'd take another look at it.
Yeah. Well, that's also, you know, in all the stories that we hear, there's always elements of luck. It's just the nature of it.
It is, right? Yeah.
And we, you know, we interview people who have been successful, you know, people who haven't been, and there are lots of those people.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we haven't talked to them, so I don't know what to
say. Well, maybe so. Maybe so. That would be interesting, what they would say, whether they'd...
I mean, it's great if...
Yeah.
You know, but everybody goes through it, it's not easy.
Yeah,
and it's a really typical story to, you know, oh, that didn't work, so we had to scramble and find something that would.
Yeah, right?
That's another common theme.
Have you interviewed very many people that said, I seriously thought about giving up,
No, because we're talking to the people who were... they're going to stick it out no matter what.
Which at a certain point could become a fool's errand, right? Yeah. I've got to do it no matter what.
Well, no, that's it. But see, there's the element of luck. It is a fool's errand, or it could be a fool's errand. And at the end, if you see it through, right? But we're talking to people who saw it through to success. So
yeah.
It's interesting, an interesting sample that we...
Yeah, it is. I was thinking about, you know, probably the darkest point was after the relaxant failure. And, you know, looking back on it, if somebody would have said, hey, you want to go get into the consumer electronics business?
Yeah.
I don't know what I would have done.
Yeah, but that wasn't... you had two products.
We did.
You know, it wasn't the end of that
company. Yeah, that's true. That's very true. It's always good to have a backup plan.
Yeah.
For sure. Always good to have a backup plan, yeah.
I want to ask you about the Biotechnology Institute.
Yes.
You've gotten involved in that.
And, yep.
Sort of the education piece, and you're involved in the BioGenius program. So tell me about that interest.
I've been on that board for a long time. and I haven't been to the bio meeting for 2 years, I think. Mm-hmm. But, man, every time you look at those kids and what they're doing, it is unbelievable. And to see the experiments they're running and the competitions that they go through, you know, that's a pretty big deal now. These top students are doing all kinds of science competitions, but to see them, to see what they're doing and how they're thinking and knowing what impact they can have on the future of science is mm-hmm. unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's very exciting.
Yeah, it had to start somewhere, right? So when it was, what made you thought that? What made you think that, you know, it could?
It, I think I got tagged with it because it was a local program, as I recall. It might have been a Pennsylvania program that we thought, let's try to take this national. And so we talked them into letting, basically, I think that's how the Biotech Institute started, I think, as I recall. Let's take this program, let's go national, we'll start this thing called the Biotech Institute, and we'll be able to reach more kids. And so they said, oh, it's a great idea. Why don't you be the chairman if you, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's how I didn't get stuck with it. I mean, it's been very rewarding. Ups and downs in terms of fundraising, but just, you know, again, it's the gratifying part of the business because you talk, any CEO or company you talk to about science education, they will listen and become engaged. Mm-hmm. So it is a very common bond that we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting to me because we're working with education too, trying to get something going. You know, we've got things in the works, but you know, it's a crowded space.
It is a crowded space. Yeah, and I think that's a really good point because I think what we've been looking to do is there a way to combine programs to get critical mass? Because there are a lot of programs that are really good that are frankly under-resourced. And to bring things together, mm-hmm. that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. I'd be happy to talk to you further about that. I think that's, looking for homes that could be homes for a couple of programs, because the infrastructure's there on the institute, and it works great, but it's got to go to the next level somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So okay, I will have Heather, our CEO, and Ian, our director of education.
Yeah.
Should I have them call you?
Absolutely, have them call me, and just compare notes on this.
Yeah.
Because we've had discussions about other things to combine it with. How can you step up the visibility and even have more of an impact? And always looking for opportunities to do that. Yes, I would be happy to talk to them, and I would be greatly appreciative of you arranging it.
Sure. Okay. Very good. Tom, is there anything else we should know about your career?
I'm trying to think if there's anything else that we didn't cover. I feel so fortunate. I feel there's been so much good fortune. I was thinking over the weekend, what should we include, and mm-hmm. Things like the coincidence of my first day at Lilly being such an important day. This biotech assessment at Serono, boy, if I had that notebook,
that would be a real
yeah. It would probably look so rudimentary. It would What a document that was. I mean, that was early days. I mean, I think we had Biogen come in. We had everybody come in and pitch us.
Yeah.
I consider myself very fortunate. I'll bet most of the people you've talked to do as well.
Yeah. Certainly. It's a great field. If you think of any other stories.
Yep.
Along the way,
you know,
we can add them in. Let me know.
Okay.
If something occurs to you.
Yes, I will see. You did a good job of covering everything, so I think.
Yeah, I think. Well, we do a fair amount of research ahead of time.
Yes, you did. And, yeah, thank you. Thank you. All right, terrific. It was great meeting you, and it was really fun to recollect. And thanks for being so patient with me.
Okay, well, this will end up, you know, we'll get the transcript, and then we'll get it back to you, and with your permission, we'll publish it in our digital archive, our biotech hall of fame.
Yeah, well,